All right. While you are finishing your meal and you just be at leisure, you just eat at your own pace. We were tentatively scheduled for about 10 minutes of Q&A, but y'all gave me a lot more than 10 minutes of questions. And so I'm going to do my best because I do want to honor the time and be through at 1:30. So I will work through this as best I can, and we'll see what we can come up with. All right. Is there something wrong with me if I think my wife looks sexy in my flannel shirt and nothing else? To each his own. That's all I'll say. As a wife, how can I encourage my husband to be the spiritual leader without nagging or taking over? Working backwards, you just don't take over. You just force yourself. I know a woman's tendency is to, when you see a vacuum in this area, to fill it. You have to resist the urge to do that. Now, don't misunderstand me. Does that then mean that you would neglect the spiritual welfare of your children? No. But it does mean that you don't take on the responsibility that God has given to your husband. My wife would tell you the best thing you can do for your husband is to pray for him. Besides that, you can encourage him. When he does do things that do move in a spiritual direction, praise him. Affirm him, applaud him. It is just the way that we are wired that will inspire him, I believe, to want to do better at that and to do more of that. Encourage him to be active in the church. Encourage him to spend time with godly men. But ladies, be careful to not cross the line to nagging and berating and criticizing. But I would encourage you not to do what God has called him to do. Simply pray that God will move in his heart, that he will take the lead and will move in that direction. And again, to quote my wife, nothing would be more valuable than that you would pray diligently that God would cultivate in his life and in his heart a desire to be a spiritual leader. Do you have a time set aside when you study and read the Bible as a couple? What is your plan? I'm going to be very honest with you all this afternoon. This is probably the one area that I have the greatest weakness and in some ways regret. Do we study together? Yes. Do we pray together? Yes. Do we do it like clockwork every day? No, we don't. Part of that, if I were to make an excuse, is simply the way that I'm wired, the way it was our family life with four boys that were very active. So we were always having to grab time here, squeeze this in here, squeeze this in there. So I have not had with Charlotte the kind of, routine that probably would have been better. We would have been better served to have done this. So I don't have a plan. Now, we do, again, read together. We talk a lot. We are big talkers once the light goes out in our bedroom at night. And you say, well, you're not talking about the Bible. We're talking about things that are in a spiritual context most of the time, by virtue in part of what I do, but in part because, well, tomorrow I'll talk about this. I won't talk to it specifically, so I'll do it now. I had a student come see me some years ago that asked me how I raised, and this is the way he said it, how did I raise such good boys? And I quickly responded to him by saying, my boys are like any other boys. They have their good days, their bad days. There are times when I'm really proud of them. There are times when I've been disappointed with them. But it is true, God has been good to us. God gave us, and I said this to him, four low-maintenance children. None of them were a problem in the adolescence, teenage years. They just never were. All the years were fun. They're all going into ministry. They're all involved in ministry. I have four sons in seminary right now, though that was never my goal or design. And I did share this with him. I said, all I told my sons growing up was that I wanted them to love the Lord Jesus and then do whatever they wanted to do. And they've each gravitated to different types of ministry. But I did take very seriously, and so I'm kind of backing into this question in a way. I did take very seriously Deuteronomy 6. I always have. You teach your children when they lie down, when they get up, when they walk, and when they sit. Which, of course, means you teach them all of the time. Now, does teaching them all the time mean you're sitting them down, you know, many hours a day with very intentional sitting behind a desk or on the couch Bible study? No. It means you're always looking for opportunities to teach them. You're looking for teachable moments. Now, again, all of our lives, we have been in church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday nights, other activities. But we also were a family that had a lot of fun. And so we watched football games together. We watched basketball games together. I went to all of their games. And we were always looking for opportunities to talk about things of a spiritual nature that could impact their life. And so, in a sense, that was my plan. And I try to tell some of my students at the seminary that are a little bit too uptight, just relax. Just relax. Play with your kids. Watch television with them. Go to their ball games. Don't make everything a grade A spiritual crisis, because it isn't. Just be a normal person. Just be normal. Regular. And again, the bottom line for me is have fun with your kids with a view to looking for opportunities to teach them about the Lord. It worked really well with our four. Now, you may have a child that will require more intentional attention. Then do it. You do what you have to do. I guess I could also add in that regard, Charlotte has been incredibly flexible given what God has called me to do. And so she was comfortable with us carrying on spiritually the way that we have. And I think she would still say, yeah, I wish Danny had been a bit more structured in maybe a particular definite prayer time, a particular definite thing to study through. And I will confess, I think I probably failed in that area in terms of measuring up to what I should have done in that regard. So I will take that as a serious flaw in my own personal life. Why would God tolerate polygamy even with kings that did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? For example, seems to suggest 14 wives as an honorable thing. Well, God tolerated it with the kings in the same way He tolerates you and me in our sin. God has made it very clear what the ideal is. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. The two shall become one flesh. And as Jesus said, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. God in grace allows a departure from His ideal. If He did not, none of you would be here today, nor would I. We'd all be consumed in His righteous judgment. And so in the same way that God gives grace to us, God extended grace there, though that was no evidence that He was approving or applauding what was taking place there. What should the spiritual relationship look like? Do you read devotionally together? Do you pray together? Well, I just answered that in part. The spiritual relationship should look like you've got Christ at the front and the forefront of all that you do, and that everything you do is done in the context of 1 Corinthians 10:31. Whether we eat or drink or whatever we do, do it all to the glory of God. Again, I try to teach my boys to do that when they played football, basketball, baseball, soccer, and other things. I try to teach them to do that when they were in school as students. Yes, my son Timothy one day said, you're saying the way I study math will either bring glory to God or it won't. And I said, you're right, and you're not doing it right now with your grades. And so, no. Every sphere of life is to be brought under the Lordship of Christ and to be done to His honor and His glory. And I do, you know, do I do it perfectly? No. But is that truly always at the forefront of my mind? It is. It really is. And when I see that I'm not doing it, I will go back and ask for forgiveness. I will try to make corrections. I will try to change my behavior. Because I truly not only would rather die than be unfaithful to Charlotte, I'd rather die than be unfaithful to Christ. I just really would prefer God just to drop me dead right now up here in front of you all than for me to go out and do something that is going to dishonor Him and hurt His body. I just would. Why do you believe so many Christian marriages are failing today? Because of what I said at the very beginning. One, we're not following the biblical patterns and the biblical guidelines for how to build a marriage. That's one. Secondly, we've been deceived by the world into thinking that we have a right to be happy rather than a responsibility to be obedient. I think that thirdly, there's a huge word missing in the vocabulary of far too many marriages today, including Christian marriages, and that is the word commitment. Commitment. You all, like I, stood at an altar and said, forsaking all others, I do, till death do we part. You made a commitment. I made a commitment. And either we are people of our word or we're not. We live in a culture where your word doesn't really matter much anymore. There was a time, I wasn't alive, I've read about it, where you could seal a deal with a handshake. My goodness, today, when you try to seal a deal, such as buying or purchasing a home, you have to fill out papers that are that thick. I mean, what's this all about? It's incredible. But that has come about because we're no longer people of our word. We're not people that you can trust what they say. And so for many Christians today, I fear that you've got people that are low in their level of commitment. They think they have a right to be happy. They've let the thinking of the world influence them more than the thinking of the Bible. And we have a culture today in the church that says, and I've had this said to me at least a dozen times over the year, I know it's wrong, but God will forgive me. Let me tell you something. God is a forgiving God, but that is not the attitude that receives the forgiveness of God. Now, don't misunderstand me. There's a difference between having all of your sins forgiven through the perfect atoning work of Christ and you experiencing daily forgiveness for the sins that you commit that will break the fellowship that you enjoy with Christ. And when you say, I know this is wrong, but God will forgive me, do you realize how cheaply you are treating the blood of Christ when you make a statement like that? You're saying, in essence, yes, I know that what I'm going to do caused Jesus to die on the cross and experience a brutal execution, but I don't care. There is something so deeply wrong with that spiritually. And I fear that, again, we have too many people that see sin as not a big deal. Well, the cross says that sin is a huge deal. And again, I fear that we've lost our sense of the significance of what sin means and is seen to be in the eyes of God, and how then we should respond in our own lives. My granny jammies, I just love this, my granny jammies, I guess that's the same thing as pajamas, my granny jammies are warm and the sexy clothes are cold. I love this. How do we compromise on a temperature for our thermostat to be on at night for us to both be happy? Just ask that man to wrap his arms and legs around you. Guys, can we do that? Oh, yeah, yeah, we can do that, huh? That is a great question, and I don't want to be, I could be so playful here. You have to find a range that neither finds perfect, but both can be happy with. It's not a good word in many contexts, but you've got it here, and it is a good word here. It is the word compromise. Compromise is a good word in marriage. It's a very good word. And so, for example, in our marriage, Charlotte is like most women. She wants to go to bed, in a polar bear suit. That's just what she would prefer. I rather sleep with no polar bear suit and a box fan and a fan on a stand that's blowing on me all night long. Now, she's at least been converted to the necessity of the noise for the fan, but she doesn't like necessarily the cold air of the fan. Well, there's a couple of things you can do here. One, you can buy you a heating blanket with dual controls. They do exist. And the person that came up with that is a very smart guy, just like the guy that came up with two sink bathrooms. That man has saved millions of marriages. That's a brilliant dude somewhere, all right? So you can get a heating blanket that has dual controls, or you can put an extra blanket on the bed, and like I do, I flip that sucker over on her side, and now she's got a double extra blanket, and it helps keep her warm. And so that's what I will do to make sure that she stays always warm. I'll turn the fan a different way. How do I want to say this? If she'll come to bed in a certain way, I don't care how she gets up the next morning as to what she has on her body. Does that work? I think y'all can figure out what I'm talking about there. Of course, sometimes, this is not lately, but I've said, honey, you got the flannel gown on. I don't like the flannel gown. It's not sexy. To which she says, I know. So that really kind of settled some conversations for us once the lights went out. Really, I'm just sitting there like, you know, in the bed, just wondering when she's in the bathroom, the door's shut. Well, what's it going to be? Flannel or no flannel? You know, I'm begging for no flannel, but if it's flannel, I just realize, well, okay, might as well just, you know, that's maybe tomorrow night. But anyway, you know, there are ways to work around that. And so if we start sexy, I don't care if we end up flannel. I could live with that. I personally could live with that. So that's just my own warped thinking there. I feel honesty is so important. Can you say something about that? Yes, you need to be honest. Now, I guess more fancy than that. You need to be very honest. How's that? Does that work? Let me say it seriously. In your notes, I use the phrase, you need to learn to speak the truth in love. Both of those are crucial. If you speak the truth without love, it becomes harsh and legalistic, and it's hurtful. If you have love with no truth, that's really nothing more than shallow sentimentalism, and it is of no value ultimately in the long run either. So the two need to come together, truth in love, which does mean that sometimes you need to wait before you speak because you can't say it in love. And if you can't say it in love, it's better for you just to be quiet until you can. I will also say this, though, and please don't misread this. I have always been absolutely, completely honest with Charlotte. But that does not mean that I've always told her everything. Now you say, wait a minute, how does that work? Well, it works, I think, essentially in ministry. I've had people in ministry that have been, I know you won't believe this, but very ugly to me. They have written me scathing letters. I have been cursed out to my face. I have been chewed up one side and down the other, over the telephone, face to face. By God's grace, I can't remember a single time in all those years where that happened that I lost my temper. And I'm not wired that way. I naturally fly off pretty quickly, but I never have. Well, did I always go home and tell Charlotte all of the gory details of those experiences? No. In fact, sometimes I didn't tell her at all. You say, well, why not? And I certainly didn't tell my kids, okay? Because they didn't need to hear it. To not pat myself on the back, I'm a big boy. I can handle it. I can take a hit, a word of criticism like that, give it to the Lord, and go home and not have high blood pressure, anxiety attacks, or sleeplessness. Furthermore, I don't have to dump all the garbage that I sometimes have to deal with on my mate, and certainly get on my children. Some of you that are in here that are in ministry make a huge mistake in this area. And as a result of that, you wind up having a bitter mate and children who hate the church. Now, let's just be fair for a moment. Are there wonderful people in the church? Yes, most of the people in the church are wonderful. Most of them are. But is it going to be the case in every church that there are people that have issues? Yes, yes. And some of them are not nice. They're mean. Some of them are not kind. They're angry. And if they get a chance, they'll take it out on you. Now, here's the way my mind works. I would rather them come and take it out on me than somebody else. Because at least it's confined to me. Secondly, I really have developed the ability to give it to the Lord. And move on. Just move on. And keep my focus on Christ. And make a judicious decision as to, is there any of this I need to share with my sweet Charlotte? Or is there some of this that I need to share with her? And I make those calls. I'm not trying to hide or keep anything from her. I'm actually trying to protect her. And sometimes the protective thing I can do for Charlotte, and in the past especially for my sons, is just to not say anything. Because what happens is, of course, they will see that person differently from now on. And whereas I may be able to forgive them, you know, God gives you the grace. I'm not a Bill Gothardite, but I agree with Gothard on this. God gives you the grace to handle offenses against you. He doesn't give you the grace to handle somebody else's offenses. So why should I give that to my wife, wherein God's not giving her the grace to deal with it? She may get bitter, angry. It may cause her to see that person in a way that would make it more difficult for her to minister and love on them in the future. So when it comes to something like that in ministry, I kind of ease back and I make those kind of judgment calls. I think the same thing would be true, though, in life in general. If I, you know, am working as an accountant somewhere, or I'm a banker, or I'm a lawyer, or I'm a plumber, or I'm a painter, whatever it is. Do I need to always just dump on my mate all the stuff that maybe I experienced that day? No, I don't think so. Sometimes I may need to, but if I don't need to, then I'm not going to. And I can just handle it on my own without getting upset about it. This romance thing, is it bigger than a bread box? That depends on your wife. What is your view on wives working outside the home? Well, I should have just left that one for another time. No, I don't mind taking that one on head on. Bottom line, you use the word wives. Let me adjust the word and work backwards. What is my view of mothers working outside the home? I personally believe, unless there is an extraordinary extenuating circumstance during the years that your children are in their early development stage all the way through their high school years, it is best for the mother to be at home. Will I say to any one of you that I think you're in sin if you're not doing that? No, because the Bible doesn't speak to it with that type of directness and that type of specificity. What the Bible does make crystal clear is that your children are not to be sacrificed on the altar of any type of career or any type of financial motivation, whether it be the husband or the wife, okay? When we got married, we made a commitment that when the children showed up, Charlotte, who at that time was working outside the home as a wife to help me go through college, would go home. She did. We start off with twins. And when she did, we were living in a home in Garland, Texas, and I was making all of $5,800 a year as a part-time minister at a church. You say, you can't live off of that. Well, we did. We did. We never bounced a check. We never went without a meal. Now, I can still remember very clearly having $2.50 in the bank account, knowing I wouldn't get paid for two more weeks. I don't remember what happened, but we didn't go hungry. I can remember going to interview with a church one time, and they didn't even take us out to dinner after the interview. They went out to the church parking lot, got in their cars, and drove home, and we're standing there with our youngest son about 4 hours away from home. We stayed at a hotel that night that was the cheapest one we could find, and on the way home the next day, we shared a box of Dairy Queen chicken because that's all the money we had to our life. And I mean, I sat there in the car, as did she, and tears ran down her face, and they nearly ran down mine, and I'm thinking, Lord, what is this all about? I mean, we have been faithful, we have honored you, we have sought to obey you, and this is where we are. But you know what? God was faithful. And today I have four sons that walk with God, that are masculine males, but that love Christ. And one's a pastor, one's a Bible teacher and a basketball coach, one's going to be a missionary, one's going to be a church planter. If you were to ask me this afternoon, why do you think your boys turned out the way that they did, I will tell you, because they had a godly, godly mother who poured her life into them, and she felt her kids were more valuable than anything she might want for herself. Now, do I feel very strongly about that? You better believe it. And if you sacrifice your children on the altar of a career, you are a fool. Now, having said that, can I then say in each and every and all situations, it is wrong for a mother to work outside the home? No, I cannot. And can I say that it's wrong for a wife to work outside the home? No, I cannot. No, I will not. But I will say again that if you are, again, sacrificing the time and the energy and the investment that you ought to be making in your children for something other than that, I think then you've made a sinful decision and you have played the fool. And so for me, there's not a higher calling in life than to be a mother who pours her life into her. My wife is going to touch the world. Charlotte will touch the world through her four sons. I would remind all of you that there was a lady named Susanna Wesley who makes Margaret Thatcher look like a preschool teacher. And Susanna Wesley shook two continents through her son Charles and through her son John. Augustine, the greatest theologian the church has ever produced outside of Paul, had a mother named Monica who they said was as beautiful as anyone in the world. But when her husband died, she chose not to remarry. She poured her life into her son, Augustine. The greatest preacher of the ancient world was a man named John Chrysostom. His mother, the woman by the name of Anathusia, was likewise said to be a beautiful, radiant woman. She poured her life into her son, and he shook the ancient Roman Empire with his ability to preach the gospel. And so again, I think there is a great investment that can be made. Having said that, that does not exclude also the investment a father should be making in the life of his children as well. Dr. Aiken, this is a second marriage for each of us. My wife has placed her children, work, and family before our marriage. I know it's not right and deeply hurts. It isn't right. And I don't know who this is, but let me just say, well, I may take it another way. I had a couple in my church in Dallas, and they were not in a second marriage. It was their first marriage. We were doing a Bible study one time, and we were talking about priorities. And this woman immediately said, well, my top priority is my children. And I said, I was very young, so at least I had enough sense not to blurt it. But I said, really? I said, your children are a higher priority than your husband? She didn't bat an eye. Absolutely. Well, I'm like in my mid-20s. But in my heart, immediately I know something's wrong here. Something is not right. The fact of the matter is, and I'll say this in the morning, my second point of the practical application of how to love your children, let them know it, will be this. You love your children by loving your mate. The number one need in the life of a child related to love is security. And nothing brings security in the life of a child like knowing my parents love each other. You say, well, this is a second marriage. I don't care. Your little boys will learn how to love their future mate by watching you. And your little girls will learn how to love their future mate by watching you. And I want to tell you something, parents. If you would just love your mate, you'll give your kids about 95% of all they need by just watching you love their mother or you love their daddy. Again, my kids knew from the time they entered into this world that their daddy was madly, madly head over heels in love with their mother. And they knew that she was madly in love with me. They have watched us hug on each other, kiss on each other, swat each other on the backside, pick at each other, play with each other. And of course, when they, you know, what y'all quit doing, but then they're back like that watching. Because it blessed them. It blessed them. And I hope and I pray, and so far it looks like it, my sons have learned to love their wives by watching the way I love their mother. And so you just could not do anything more precious for your children than that you would just work really hard at loving your mate. How are students at Southeastern enabled to truly put their marriage and family first while attending class and studying? It is said that we are to put family first, but difficult to do without shifting school responsibilities. We only take two classes at a time. Is it okay to miss class for family, like when you reschedule church talks? Yes. I will say this to all of you. If you're a student of mine and you have the option of making an A in my class or an F at home, or making a C in my class and making an A at home, make the C in my class. Because people will not ask you in the future, what did you make in Dr. Aiken's hermeneutics class, but they'll take vital interest in how healthy your marriage and family life is. For me, when I was in seminary, it did mean taking less hours and extending the time I was in school. It did mean in certain classes that I took a B rather than an A. It did mean that I had to say no to some good things in order to say yes to some better things. Now, did I do it perfectly? No. And there are times when I think I probably made a bad call. But the fact of the matter is, you will find the time for what you think is most important. You just will. And so if your marriage and your family is most important, as it ought to be, then you'll carve out the time you need. But again, some of you students in particular, this is not the guy you want sympathy from, because I started with two children when I began seminary and had three and a fourth on the way by the time I finished. And I had a student come to see me one day that was complaining about this and said, I can't find any time to study. I'm so busy. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And I know I'm neglecting my family, but I don't want to neglect my family. So what do I do? So I said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, on Saturdays, does your family tend to sleep late on Saturday? Ours does, always has. Do you tend to sleep late on Saturday? Oh, yeah, we do. We'll sleep to 9, sometimes 10 o'clock. I said, great. You get up at 6. He said, do what? I said, get your buns up at 6. You get up at 6. They get up at 9 or 10. I just found you 3 or 4 hours every Saturday. I said, Sunday, you take the Baptist nap every Sunday afternoon? Yeah, we usually go down from 2 to 4:30. I said, not anymore. I said, they can, but you're not. I said, my goodness, I just found you 2.5 more hours. I have found you 6.5 hours of study time in 2 days. Would you like me to move to Monday? No. Now, you say you're kidding. I'm not kidding. I am not kidding. When I was in seminary and college, I got up and I would try to find study time that did not, as much as I could, that was not taking anything away from Charlotte and the boys. And so when they are asleep, they don't mind if I'm somewhere studying. Now, was it taxing? Yes. Physically draining? Yes. Were there times when I would just virtually collapse? Yes. Were there times where I just had to realize I couldn't do any more and I'd done the best that I could before God and I would have to trust Him that He would take my best and honor it? Yes. But I was not, and again, I have many faults, but I was not lazy. And I didn't play games. I didn't run around. You know, sometimes at our school, I see some of our male students over there playing ping pong and pool, and I just want to take the pool stick and smack it across the back of their head. Because I know that their wife is somewhere working, and you say, well, you worked the whole time you were in seminary? You better believe I worked the whole time I was in seminary, the whole time I was in college. Why wouldn't I? Well, your wife was working. Well, so what? I'm going to let her work and I'm going to go play pool, ping pong, basketball. And what's that all about? I mean, what is that all about? And I'm a big sports fan, boys and girls. I mean, I know right now, by the way, I had a chance to go watch Kentucky play North Carolina. But my two boys and two daughter-in-laws are there. And I know Wake Forest is playing Georgia Tech. And I know this afternoon USC is playing UCLA. And I know tonight that Florida plays I know all this. I know, believe me. You're looking at a wild sportsman up here. But you know what? As much as I love sports, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans in comparison to being a godly man and setting the right example as a husband and a father. If that means turning off the TV, getting up early, staying up a little late to be doing and accomplishing all that I have to do, then I just do it. You just do it. And it's this very wonderful biblical word called discipline. Now, again, I'll say this as I close. I'm not a brilliant person. I'm going to give most of you a big word of encouragement here as I close. I made 870 on the SAT the first time. 910 the second time. That is not a high SAT score. That means all of my life I have had to be basically a tortoise, just plugging away, plugging away, plugging away, plugging away, plugging away, plugging away, plugging away. But I've learned this. Even if you have very, very little, if you as an act of worship and humility, give what you have to God. And you do the best you possibly can before the Lord, He will amaze you at what He'll let you do. He will stun you. He will blow your socks off that He will let you be and do and see some of the things that you'll get to do. He just will. But that does mean that you are a disciplined person. Not a crabby person. Not a hyper kind of structured individual that drives everybody nuts. No. But you are diligent at getting done what needs to get done. You prioritize. And you make sure that that first and that second and that third and that fourth priority get done no matter what. And if the others get done, fine. If they don't, you got one done, you got two done, you got three done, you got four done. God will honor that. And even though you can't make more time, God has a way of making more time for you. I don't know how He does it. I really don't. But I've come to see that when I am doing my best before the Lord, it's amazing how He tends to stretch the time out for me to get done all that I need to get done. Now, that's not just true for seminary students. That's true for all of us. We're all busy. We all have responsibilities. We all have obligations. But if we are faithful to do the right things well, God amazingly will give us the time to do all the things we actually need to do. And He'll give us the ability to do them well. All right. Brother David, I'm going to let you close it as you see fit. Thank you so much for your kindness to me today. It has been an honor and a blessing for me to be with you. So thank you very much.